Good evening. Does everyone have the source sheet? Okay. So thank you very much for coming out this evening. I'm very glad that the storm is holding off until tomorrow evening, because it's only right that we should catch a break once in a while. Last year, I think almost every one of our sessions at Shari Shemayim had some weather event that evening, ranging from Sandy to, you know, in the beginning of the year, to just every time we had something. So I'm glad that the weather cooperated. I have first some administrative items to take care of. Number one is that Jeff handed out slips for an online evaluation. This is very important because in order to be able to offer credit for physicians who attend, we have to have evaluations. If you're below a certain percentage of responses, and that includes whether you're a physician or just here because you're interested in the topic, doesn't make a difference. If people don't evaluate, then the university is not necessarily going to look kindly on us for giving credit. So please do evaluate it. If you want to evaluate it nicely, that's also nice. But that's just a bonus. Also, please make sure that you sign in. I made the mistake of putting out sign-in sheets, even as Jeff put out sign-in sheets. So you only need to sign in once. If you choose to sign in twice, we will not count you twice. You will not get credits twice. We will be checking the sheets. So make sure that you do sign in at some point, please. And also note, even if you're not taking credit for this, nonetheless, it's a good idea to sign in. Because I like to follow up afterwards with items on questions that come up during the class. I will not be ready to answer every question in the session. I like to be able to follow up afterwards, so please do sign in. And as a bonus also, you will then receive notification of future CME, Medical Halacha classes, unless you don't want to, in which case we will not send you them. We need to do more with the chairs, huh? Other items that I have to make sure to cover. Yes. I would like to thank Qualicare for sponsoring this evening and in general sponsoring our medical halacha classes here as well as up at the Bayit. I'm grateful for their support. And then a couple of other very quick items, and then we'll actually get to the topic at hand. Number one, you may hear noise from down the hall from the Beit Midrash. That's actually a program that goes on here every Monday night by the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzvah Beit Midrash Zichron Dov, which I am with here in town. And it includes various opportunities to learn, including a medical ethics weekly session. It's not like the classes. It's instead text study in which a group of us study together. You are more than welcome. It's every Monday night at 8 o'clock, unless one of these classes is going on. So feel free to stop in for that. And last notes, for those who are going to the program on December 8th, we have Rabbi Dr. J.J. Schachter coming in to speak. It's a farewell reception for Rabbi Baruch and Pnina Weintraub. It was originally scheduled to be held here, but we have actually exceeded the space. So it was a choice between moving it or telling people sorry. And given that it's a Jewish event and there are 2 weeks left, we knew that there were still going to be people signing up, possibly the majority of people signing up. And so therefore we've moved it, and it's going to be held instead at B'nai Torah. So if you signed up or if you are planning on signing up for that event, please note that it is going to be at B'nai Torah. If you're interested in more information about that, see me afterwards. I will be glad to give you more information about it. I didn't want to hand out the flyers because the flyers all say Shari Shemayim and that will be confusing. But that's something I'll be glad to fill you in on afterwards. And then one last note and then we get to our topic. And that is that in general, we offer this and all of our classes, short of when we're providing food for free, and we're very glad to provide that for the community. We created recently something called a supporting membership, where for $36 a year, people are able to become supporting members. The benefit that they get is the joy of supporting our work, as well as a sign of our appreciation, there will be an annual lecture that will be open to members, and there's an email hotline for questions about Torah, and there are cards on the far table in the back. I deliberately put them on the far table because I want people to understand understand they don't have to. This is not an obligation. It's an opportunity that's there for those who wish to take advantage of it. And if you want to, please take a card. It has a website where you're able to sign up, or you can give me the card afterwards, whatever you like. And with that, we're 5 minutes in. So let's get to the topic of medical malpractice. This is a very complicated area of law in any legal system. There is a huge range of cases that come up, and the cases are complex. The literature on it is complex as well, at times providing contradictory or apparently contradictory rulings on the issue of malpractice. What I'm going to try to do in the next hour is to present some coherent thoughts on a few interesting cases, understanding that ultimately what I am saying is really tip of the iceberg. There is a lot more to be said on this, and I'd be glad, if anyone is interested, I'd be glad to provide links for articles you can find online, names of books that have been written on the topic, because it's a huge topic. I sent out in the pre-class email three scenarios, and the first of the scenarios is what I call the bystander. If you take a look at your sheet, top of the first side, Sarah is having coffee and cake with a friend at her home when the friend begins to choke. Sarah employs the Heimlich maneuver successfully, but in the process, she cracks her friend's ribs. Is Sarah liable?
For serving overly dry cake.
Yes, for serving overly dry cake, she is undoubtedly liable. The fact that, you know, it was left there and she didn't want to let it go to waste is not justification. Okay, so that part of it we understand. Sarah is liable for the cake. But moving past the cake to the ribs, is Sarah liable for the damage done to her friend's ribs? What would you say? Well, I'm asking the question specifically. It's a good point. I'm asking the question specifically from a Jewish perspective. A friend of mine who is a lawyer actually sent me a day and a half ago a lot of material on malpractice law in Canada, cases and so forth, and I promptly didn't read them because at that point it was too late. But I'm asking what you would do. In terms of Jewish law, what would you expect would be the ruling? Not liable. Okay, why? You tell me. Does not say. Let's say she's not. Because in the later cases, I'm going to say that the people are. So let's say she's not. Zeb raises an interesting question. If she failed to act, she would presumably be in violation of Lo Tamod Al Dam Re'acha, don't stand by the blood of your brother. However, is that necessarily true? In other words, imagine the following case. Imagine that there is someone who is drowning in the river, and they need someone to jump in and save them, and I don't know how to swim. Am I obligated to jump into the river just to flounder around and not save them? I am prohibited, in fact, from doing so. But is that necessarily analogous to this case? No. Why not?
Because
she's not putting herself at risk, but aside from that, she is saving the person. There's collateral damage, if you will, but she exercises the Heimlich maneuver correctly enough that she's able to prevent choking. So there is that. So let's take a look at some sources on this. If you take a look at source number one, this is a passage from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. Lo yis'asek b'refuah, elem kein hu baki. One should not involve himself in medicine unless he is an expert. V'lo yehisham gadol mimenu. And there is no one who is greater, no one who is more expert present. You have to be top physician in order to be able to treat. Very scary. I'm going to come back to it in a moment. Shim lo kein, because otherwise, harei zeh shofech damim. Otherwise, the physician who treats and ends up harming the patient is considered a shedder of blood, a murderer. Now, Ellen.
Well, I mean, for interns and residents, that's very scary.
Yeah. I mean, is this, are we to be serious about requiring that you be the most expert? So the general trend in Jewish law is to assume that no, you do not need to be the greatest expert, but it depends to a certain extent on what's going on what you're actually dealing with. So Nishmat Avram, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Avram, who I'm going to quote a lot in this session, says that you have to distinguish between cases in which the treatments are fairly standard. Yeah, and it's not like there's reason to doubt. He says, where there's reason to doubt, then what we're saying to the physician is, don't err on the side of taking charge, err on the side of caution, and consult others. If you know, and it's obvious, then you know.
What if there's no one else around?
Right. So if there's no one else around, then you are the gadol. Then you're the greatest one present.
How do you test who's the greater one?
Ah, so how do you know? Excellent question. And to my mind, it would have to be done on a very practical basis. In other words, it's not something that you're going to now, you know, try to gauge. If you can't tell, then just go do what you're supposed to do. It would have to be a clear difference of, you know, I am somebody fresh out of school, and this is a person with 25 years of experience doing this. Or, this is my field. It's my specialty, and the other person is more general, and that doesn't really know this field. Something along those lines. You would need a bright line that said, this is the person who's more expert. Rabbi J. David Blythe discusses this as well in an article in the journal Tradition in 2005. It's in It's volume 39, the first edition of that year. And he has a nice long piece on this too, regarding the need to consult more expert physicians. But as a general rule, our assumption is that if you're dealing with a case where you know what the law is, we're not going to tell you that you now... not the law, I'm confusing cases. Well, you know what the treatment is, and where it's something that people consider to be relatively routine, then there's no obligation for you to say, well, right down the hall I have somebody who's been doing this longer than I have, let me ask them too. We would not say it in that case. Yes, Beth?
What you included is a factor of expertise. What about the time factor?
Meaning?
A survey and see who's available, who's more expert than you. Well, I've got 5 years and you've got 10 years. There's a time factor.
Correct. And so when the text says "Velo yehi sham gadol mimenu," or in the English is present, I would include present not meaning specifically the physical space, but also in terms of time. In other words, you have someone who you could consult and still be able to act in an appropriate way, in an appropriate time, to be able to save the patient. We're not talking about now putting it through a survey and the poor patient is lying there choking. That's correct. But in terms of this statement, where he says one should not involve himself in healing unless he is baki, unless he is expert, and the Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Chil Michalevsky, in writing in the beginning of the 20th century, actually strengthened it. He wrote asur, which is to say, it is absolutely prohibited for one to be involved in treatment unless he knows what he's doing. Take a look at source number 2. I like this line, so I brought it on the sheet. Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Avram, in his Nishmat Avram, at the end of his discussion of this point about who is qualified to treat, says, "Va'alayla hosif," he says, I have to add, "Shal achas kama vekama sha'asur listam adam li'aitz l'chole lakachas trufa zu o acheres." He says, it is prohibited for an average person. Stam Adam means someone who is not known to have particular medical knowledge. It is prohibited for an average person to advise a patient to take this particular medicine, that particular medicine. V'lo pam shamati al adam shayatz v'gam nasan trufos kegon antibiotika. He says, more than once I've heard of a person advising and even giving medication, like antibiotics. Sure, you should take this. I have some left over, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, the physicians in the room definitely have all seen this. And perhaps the results of it. The reality is that people should not be tampering in something as serious as medicine. If you know what you're doing, fine. If you don't know what you're doing, you can't. You know, this isn't the sort of field you can fake. I'm not sure if there are fields you can fake, but this isn't one of them. If there are. So so he says you can't dabble in this as an amateur. So much so that we are taught that one who lacks certification and in any case decides to treat is liable. The rule is, in general, Adam Mu'ad La'olam is the Talmudic phrase. It means one is always considered forewarned. There's a chair right up here. Or back there. That people are always considered to be forewarned, which means that unlike with, let's say, an animal, where if I own my animal and my animal goes running out and harms someone, but it had no history of doing so, I had no reason to expect it, so I'm not going to have full liability for what that animal does. However, a human being is always liable for the consequences of his actions. That's the assumption. We're now going to break that assumption in a moment, but that's the general rule in tort law in Judaism. But that leads me to a question, which is our situation. We've now said that you're not allowed to act unless you know what you're doing. We know, as we said a few minutes ago, that Sarah, in case number one, is nonetheless obligated to act. She may not have any formal training in the Heimlich maneuver, but if she has a chance of saving the life of the person in her house, she is supposed to act. So how can you, on the one hand, say, you must act, and on the other hand say, you are liable for the results of your action? Right? This is why we have Good Samaritan laws. Because we don't want, you know, notwithstanding that Good Samaritan is not really one of our phrases. That's a longer story. But the point is, how are you going to obligate her to act and then say she's liable for the negative consequences of her action? So take a look, please, at source number three. Source number three comes from Tosfot, a set of commentaries, really, to the Talmud ranging from the 12th to the 14th centuries, maybe 13th, where he talks about not our issue, but a general issue in damages. He's talking about a case in which somebody runs into somebody else and as a result causes harm. And he says, Haka, in our case here, which we're not discussing really, so I didn't bring you the text on which he was commenting, but in the case that he's discussing, Sheniskal Machmas Mirshol, the person stumbled as a result of an obstacle. Velo Iboile Ayune, it wasn't a case in which he would have been expected to look out for that kind of an obstacle. Really, it was an unexpected thing. Anus, who? This is a case of ones. Ones means you were forced into something. You had no desire to have it happen. You did everything reasonable to avoid it. And nonetheless, you were forced into it anyway. That's what we call ones. So he is anus. He is somebody who experienced ones, and therefore he's not going to be liable. And then Tosfot addresses the question of, well, wait a minute. Didn't you just say that human beings are always responsible for the results of their actions? Even though we have already learned in the Talmud that a person who commits harm, even in an unexpected way, uncontrollable way, in an ones situation, is just as liable as a vandal, ones gamur lo rabbi rachmana. He says, the Torah doesn't say this where it is a full-blown ones situation, where you had zero control. And what he's referring to is the fact that really, there is a spectrum of negligence. It isn't as simple as saying that all activities are either, you know, or all events are either the result of negligence or not the result of negligence. There is pure negligence, okay? Someone gives me his watch and says, please take care of this for me, and I leave it out on a picnic table and it starts to rain. Okay? That is full-blown negligence, veering even towards active harm. Then you have the case in which I leave it in my house, but the window is open. And there's always a chance that it's going to start to rain, and that the rain is going to blow it and is going to harm it. But really, you wouldn't necessarily expect it. And then you have the case in which I leave it in my house, and everything is fine, and then the roof collapses, and no one expected the roof to collapse. There are degrees of liability and negligence. And he says, if it's really a full-blown ones situation, something that you could not have averted, then you're not going to be liable. And Tosfot says, I can prove this to you from a case from the Jerusalem Talmud, which I'll explain outside of the text, although you can see it there. The Talmud discusses the following case. A man lies down somewhere to go to sleep. After he falls asleep, someone else comes and lies down next to him. While the first person is sleeping, he tosses and turns in his sleep, and he lashes out and strikes the person next to him, breaks his nose, or whatever the case is. Is he liable for what happened? And the answer is no. And Tosafot says the reason the answer is no is because there was absolutely nothing he could have done. He didn't even know the person was there when he went to sleep. The person wasn't there. So Tosafot says, you see, a person is exempt from liability where it was a full-blown ones. Now, not everybody agrees with this ruling of Tosafot. The alternative ruling is presented by Nachmanides in the 13th century, where he says, that's not why the guy is not liable. You know why the sleeper isn't liable? Because this is a case of contributory negligence. Right? Because here, the second person to lie down put himself into a dangerous situation. He's lying down next to somebody who doesn't even know he's there, and he's putting himself at risk. That's not quite the same thing as, you know, potentially the other cases we could discuss. But nonetheless, the reason I bring this position of Tosafot in source number 3 is to make the argument that the woman who saves the person in her house, Sarah, who saves the person in her house from choking, is ultimately in an ones situation. She is compelled by Jewish law to act on behalf of the person in her house, and therefore you cannot hold her responsible for the breaking of the ribs, assuming she doesn't go out trying to break ribs. She's trying to save her. That's the argument that could be made on her behalf. Now, frankly, even without that, there's another reason not to hold her liable. There's another reason to exempt her from liability. And that is what I hinted at with the Good Samaritan mentioned before, which is, if you're going to hold her liable, then next time she's not going to do it. Right? Next time she's not going to do the Heimlich maneuver. Don't think that holding people liable is going to make them go out and get training. Right? Because number one, it doesn't work that way. And number two, realistically, you can't train for every unforeseen scenario. So she'll get that training, and then she'll have to do CPR on an infant, or whatever it is. You can't get training for all possible cases. And that may be the concept behind source number 4. The Rabbi Moshe Sofer, also known as the Chatam Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, dealt with the following tragic case. There's a woman who had a maid of some sort working in her home. And the maid collapsed. So she wanted to resuscitate her, and she reached for the brandy, because Rabbi Moshe Sofer is writing in the 18th century, and that was then the best way. It's probably still the best way, that I don't know. But that was the way that you would resuscitate somebody. So she reaches for the brandy and puts the bottle to this woman's mouth, and she pours some into her mouth, not realizing that, in fact, it was what the Chasam Sofer describes as petrol, some form of kerosene. And the woman dies. So the question now comes before the Chatam Sofer. This woman is miserable, and she wants to know what form of penance she should do. How does she make right this horrific wrong that occurred at her hand? And so the end of his response, and he writes the following in source number 4. Tzarech tzas tshuva. He says, yes, some repentance is required. Ach, and his reason for that is a very interesting one beyond the scope of this. It's a very interesting philosophical point. He makes the suggestion that if something bad happens through somebody, we have a principle of megalgalin zechus al yedei zakai v'chov al yedei chayav. He says, if something bad happens at someone's hand, it must be that they had done something that somehow triggered this. I don't want to go into the theology of that, because that's scary. And will take us far, far from where we are right now. But the point is, he says, so some repentance is required. However, he continues to say, Ein laha amis alea harbei. Don't burden her too much. Why? Because she's trying to save a life. She was very confused because she's acting in haste. This woman just collapsed in her house. And if we would be strict, we would cause her to stumble regarding saving lives in the future. Separate from the question of should she be liable or do we call it ones, even if it's not ones, you don't want to hold people liable for trying to save someone's life, because then they won't do it in the future. Now, some challenge that because we don't say the same thing for physicians. If a physician acts in haste, as we're going to see, the physician is still liable. So some challenge this ruling of the Chatam Sofer. But in source number 5, I brought from a work by Rabbi Tzvi Spitz called Mishpatei HaTorah, in which he says there is a substantive difference. I'm reading out of the English in the interests of time. But he says there's a substantive difference between a doctor who errs in examination or care due to haste to treat, and a regular person who tries to heal and errs due to haste. In medical school, a doctor learns that he may not treat a patient hastily without properly evaluating the nature of the illness. If you ask a layperson in an emergency to do something, they're in a panic. They don't know how much time they even have to think about the situation, let alone whether it would be of more value to think or more value to treat. So our standard is different. If a person is a layperson, they're doing the best they can. If a doctor is involved, then sometimes haste is required. Sometimes you don't have a choice. But the doctor is supposed to be able to make that sort of evaluation. So the upshot of what we say in case number one, and again, I'm not dealing with the secular law question, although it's a good one, but is that the non-physician who is put in a position to try to save lives is not going to be held responsible for harm caused during that time, either because they were required to act, and therefore you can't also hold them responsible for the harm that they caused, or because we will say that we want to make sure they're going to take care of people in the future. And then as far as the fact that haste in general a physician would be liable for, that's physicians, that's not lay people. So we learn here a couple of ethics. Number one, the ethic of requiring intervention. And number two, that one has to work with the best of one's training, such as it is. You're not going to hold someone liable for training they don't have. Yes?
So if we make it a bit more ridiculous, let's say this person, instead of doing a Heimlich maneuver, does something completely ridiculous, like applying blood suckers or something, old kind of thinking that would help. Okay? And it doesn't help. Maybe the person spontaneously just is able to clear the choking episode. So would that person then be liable? Because Sarah tried to help, though she did something ridiculous.
Interesting. The argument, I suppose,
if you're not criticizing her, then you're going to continue to do these ridiculous attempts at saving lives in the future.
Right. I don't know that you can punish her for being ignorant. I mean, we don't want her to remain ignorant.
Right.
We'd like to train her. But I don't think you can punish her. It sort of reminds me of, even though this is not directly analogous, but it gives me the opportunity to plug the Monday night series again. That Monday nights at 8 p.m. every single week, we have a medical ethics, medical halacha chabura, a group of us who study medical halacha texts together. It's actually source number two, the Nishmat Avram. That's the book that we use. But there we were discussing the situation of trying to save someone's life on Shabbos. And one of the points that was made was that people are not supposed to ask questions. They're simply, if they have any doubt that someone's at risk, they should, go immediately to the expert. And if that requires driving, you go to the doctor that way or whatever it is. And there we made the point that it's upon the communal authorities to make sure that people know that. They are responsible to make sure that the community is aware that this is, in fact, their responsibility. We don't say to the individual who was ignorant, we do say. We do say, to a certain extent. The truth of the matter is that it's actually pretty harsh in its wording towards the person who does it. But my inclination is to think it's the responsibility of communal authorities to make sure people know this sort of thing, including what to do in an emergency situation. The individual should try to be educated, but I would be hard-pressed to say that they're actually going to be liable for the results of the leeching that they did in the case that you describe. They believed this was the way to save the patient. They just didn't know what they were doing. That's my gut. But as I said in the beginning, please make sure to sign in, because I like to follow up afterwards on cases that come up and questions that come up. And I want to look into this and see what others will say. So, God willing, I'll be back in touch. Yeah.
Of a child that died of strep.
Yeah.
And the mother did not give the child antibiotics. She gave the child some alternative holistic medication of some sort. And so then the mother was being charged with failure to provide.
Right. But there she had the benefit of medical advice. She's liable because she didn't follow medical advice. Here, it's an ignorant person.
We're assuming that
there
were doctors there and chose not to.
What about the opposite? If you withhold the vaccine, the child dies with communicable disease and could have been saved.
Yes, so we do say one is liable.
Okay.
even though there are those who will dispute regarding vaccines, because the great weight of medical opinion is
the administration that's still responsible, because we don't have regular demonstrations of the medical equipment that we have in the shul.
That's a really interesting question.
You had it last year once.
No, but in all seriousness, I would say that the community is, I think, would be well advised to, in general, to make sure the public knows, not from a liability standpoint, but from a halachic standpoint, that the community is aware of what to do in cases of emergency, to the extent possible. Obviously, you can't have a seminar every single week, but I think that there should be regular training. I don't think that's crazy.
If there is a complication that's known, such as a known potential complication, such as breaking a rib when you do Heimlich, I mean, you might get somebody who's only after the ribs and whatever, and you do the Heimlich and you're frozen. I mean, it doesn't matter to me whether it's a physician or otherwise, whether, you know, who does it, as long as the patient is safe. But what is it in Jewish ethics? Is there a liability there if it's a known complication?
So, right. No. If it's a known complication, in other words, an expert doing this would have encountered the same thing, then it's not an issue. I meant specifically because she didn't know what she was doing, therefore she cracked the patient's ribs. But no, if it's something that's just a natural byproduct of treating the patient, then that's what you do. You know, in the same way that you have to amputate sometimes to save a patient's life. If that's part of the treatment, that's part of the treatment. I'm going to go a little further now because we've done this case, you know, with some depth, and we still have to see the next case, which I think is the major one. The surgeon's hand slips. Do you see the case in front of you? Case number 2. Judith, a trained, board-certified cardiac surgeon, operates carefully, but her hand slips and she severs a blood vessel. If you don't like that, you feel that's unrealistic, you know, come up with another version of this. But the point is that something happens while she is trying to perform the surgery in which she inflicts harm as a result of her hand slipping. There is no intent. Her hand slipped. You can think, of course, of numerous things that could have caused her hand to slip. There was a sudden noise in the room. She was fatigued. She was rushing. Whatever you want to give. The patient survives. Because I don't want to deal with the case where the patient dies, because that creates a whole new realm of complication in the sources. The patient survives. But the injury creates complications and a longer recovery time. Is Judith liable? What would you say?
Yes.
Yes. Why? I heard a yes.
Ask the patient.
Well, the patient might be grateful for a successful surgery. Yeah.
We hope for it beforehand that there's a concept that if you make people liable for doing something, they will not do it. Is that rabbinic or is that
You talk about specifically in terms of rescue.
Well, anything when it comes down to this. So that any physician, there's no one that can do everything right all the time.
Right.
No physician and they're no expert. So if you make every single person in the previous situation and the situation always liable for the human error that exists in all of us, then no one would go forward.
Right.
So if that's a biblical concept, then all these questions are answered for. And if it's a rabbinic, then you're going to pick case by case.
Right. Right. So as she asks the question of, are you really going to tell me that the physician is going to be held liable for any error? And if so, how is there any hope for a physician? And so the question would be, what is the basis for saying, in fact, that we don't want to hold people liable for everything? So the answer to that is, in fact, that the principle is a rabbinic principle, and it is applied in certain cases, not others, but we're going to see that. So hold off a little bit with that. Yes?
There's a question of law as well. It differs Canada and the United States. All questions, what is malpractice versus what is medical misadventure? Where medical misadventure in the States is something you can sue for. Where medical misadventure in Canada is, well, it's a potential side effect of doing the procedure.
Right. I'm very curious to know about misadventure versus malpractice, but okay. But I'm going to hold off on it just because I'm an expert in neither legal system. So you know, the differences between them would just be to multiply my ignorance. But in terms of the issue of halacha and what we're actually going to say to this physician, Take a look at source number 6, please. The bottom of the first side. This is from a Tosefta, just by way of explanation. The Talmud is supposed to be the canon of the history of the verbal tradition that accompanies the biblical text, meaning that biblical text is accompanied by explanation down through the generations. Once you get to the beginning of the Common Era, the sages feel a need to write this down because it is being forgotten for reasons beyond the scope of tonight's talk. They first compose the Mishnah, which is a basic outline, and that's canonized in the beginning of the 3rd century Common Era. They then set out to work on an expansion of it called Gemara. Together, Mishnah and Gemara are called Talmud. However, there were sources that were contemporary with the Mishnah that were not canonized in Mishnah. Sometimes because there were questions about their authenticity, sometimes because they were considered redundant, sometimes because not all the sages had access to them. Those were then canonized separately in a work called Tosefta, which means that which is added. So what we're about to see is actually found in Tosefta, source number 6. Rofei Uman, Sheripei Birshut Beit Din Vihizik, Patur, an expert doctor who treats with court authorization. Okay, we're now imagining some kind of certifying body that we're calling a Beit Din, that we're calling a court. It's interesting to note the Hebrew has Sheripei with a hey. I was very bothered by that because it should be an aleph. I'm not clear on why that is so, but I left it in because that was the way it was in the source that I was copying it from. In any case, if he heals with court authorization but causes harm in the process, patur midine adam, he's exempt in human law, v'chayav bidine shamayim, and is liable in the court of heaven. God is going to have to take this person to account. Human courts will not. So what was this licensing? It is not at all clear. According to my reading, formal licensing in general society does not begin until the 13th century. There's a very good paper that's available online by a fellow named Stephen F. Friedel. It's an article from the Journal of International and Comparative Law, Spring 2006. The article is titled Medical Malpractice in Jewish Law. And he has actually a very interesting discussion about the Middle Ages, how communities, not Jewish communities, but general communities, had what were called communal physicians during that time, that they were hired by the community. And he suggests possible connections between the licensing discussed here by a Beit Din and whatever body would act on behalf of the community to hire the communal physician. It's an interesting article. But in terms of what we're saying here, this source seems to say that if that doctor gets that certification, that authorization, by whoever is entrusted with checking out the doctors, and then he causes harm, he's exempt in human law, liable in heavenly law. So why should this physician be exempt just because he got certification? What is the value of the certification, Jack?
Well, I presume what happened was an accident. It was not intentional.
And how does his authorization demonstrate that?
It doesn't. His authorization just allows him to be in the operating room.
But then why should he be exempt?
The authorization allows him to work on the patient, and he makes whatever an unintentional mistake. And so, why? In other words, is he held to a standard of perfection that any mistake that he makes, he's liable for?
Well, it sounds like just the opposite, because we've said already before that an amateur who tries to heal and causes harm is going to be held liable. Not talking about the case of saving the person who's choking in the kitchen, but just in general. I have a friend who's sick. I feel like I'm going to give him advice. Here's some medicine. Take it and see what happens. I'm going to be held liable as an amateur doing it. Why is the certified, tested physician going to be exempt from liability? Ellie?
The same as the judge also.
Yeah?
Same idea. So if somebody is at the cutting edge of technology, or whatever it is, he's doing the best that can be done. He may make a mistake. But if an amateur tries something, then it's almost reckless, and it's responsible for the mistake.
Right. The idea is that a person who has gone through the training and established expertise, has done everything he could to keep himself from this sort of error, And therefore, if something happens, he's not going to be held responsible. That seems to be the idea behind it, and we do have parallels in the laws of other professions and other types of professional malpractice. Zev, you were going
to
say?
Well, just look at your first, your records, number one. You have to go to the original source.
Yeah.
The Shulchan Aruch was quoted, and that'll tell us if you're finding a bakhi, this undoubtedly relates to the definition of bakhi.
Yeah.
What the Shulchan Aruch was using to learn the first.
But it's the other way around. The Shulchan Aruch is getting it from source number six.
Yes, exactly. So what I want to do is I want to look at what is the source for one. What is the Shulchan Aruch?
Right, and the answer is six.
Okay.
Yes, six and seven also.
The bigger question is why would I use Shulchan
Aruch? Ah, so Heshy asked the question the other way. We're asking the question of why he's exempt from liability for an accident. He's exempt in a human court. But why is he liable then in the heavenly court? So take a look, please, at source number seven. Thank you for the segue. Take a look, please, at source number seven, which is very interesting. It talks about various professionals. First, it talks about a kohen. A kohen is a priest who does the work in the Beis HaMikdash in the temple. And it says that if a kohen, in the process of working in the temple, accidentally disqualifies an offering, then he is exempt from liability. If he does it intentionally, though, he's going to be liable for tikkun olam, taking tikkun olam simply as the repair of the world, the way to improve the world. Now there, tikkun olam means, technically he shouldn't be liable at all, even if he does it intentionally, because this is what's called hezek sheino nikar, invisible harm. You can't look at the carbon, at the offering, and see any difference. But in order to keep the kohanim, the priests, from being careless, we say, okay, they're going to be liable, because otherwise we're afraid that they're going to run amok. Then the second piece, an agent of the court, who is charged with issuing lashes. If he strikes with the authorization of the court and causes harm anyway accidentally, he's exempt. If he does it intentionally, he's going to be liable for tikkun olam, again, for the sake of the world. There, it seems to be referring to the first half of the sentence. The fact that he's exempt for anything done in the service of the court is because otherwise we won't be able to have the court carry out what it needs to carry out. Leave aside the question of corporal punishment. It's a fun discussion, but not for right now. The third case is the medical case. Rofei Uman, an expert doctor who treats with court authorization and harms accidentally, is exempt. If he does it intentionally, he is liable for tikkun olam. Which half of the sentence is the tikkun olam, is the repair of the world? The exemption for harming accidentally or the liability for harming intentionally? Ostensibly, it's the first half. And that's the way virtually all authorities view it. Rabbi Bleich, in his article in Tradition, does quote one author who takes the opposing view, but the near universal view is that what we're saying here is, really, he should be liable. And if he does it intentionally, he is liable. However, if he harms accidentally, then he's going to be exempt from liability because of tikkun olam, because we need this world, we need to have physicians, and therefore we want to protect them, we want to indemnify them.
You don't care about the person who's damaged.
I don't think we...
Remember, so you have a person who's damaged in a position.
Yeah.
Who should suffer, who should bear the responsibility for the damage that's caused? You have room for a physician, you know, but 90% of them would say, physician, well, if you're a patient, you're damaged, why should you bear the suffering and the physician not? The physician, at least in civil law, can insure himself. The patient can't insure himself. The patient suffers the damage. The patient's damage may be greater than a few dollars the physician has to pay for insurance.
Right.
You may suffer for the rest of your life. It may be life-changing.
Right. It's a worthwhile point, and I think that that's what they're wrestling with when they try to set the standard for how the physician has to train himself and get the certification. In other words, we're not talking about someone who entered this in a foolhardy way. We're talking about someone who did all the steps we would expect of a person, and yet something happened anyway. And I think... I get the theory of the patient has no means of protecting himself, but I think that the physician has also taken serious steps to avoid the mishap. Now, we still have to talk more about how the mishap happened. We haven't gotten to why the hand slipped. that's where I want to go next. But the but I think they're wrestling with that issue and saying, well, we're requiring certain steps from the doctor, and then at that point we're saying the doctor has now done enough. Ellen, you had your hand up.
Yeah, like, I mean, if it's a true accident that could not have been avoided at all, I don't see why the physician should be liable. I mean, I guess that false point. The patient, maybe they could sue, but that's why the physician takes out insurance, because there are human errors and the patient, you know, deserves compensation. But that doesn't mean that the physician, you know, should be punished in some way, and certainly not from a halakhic point of view.
You know, procedures where one out of a thousand people will suffer a stroke or a heart attack or die. You hope you're not the one out of a thousand, but it doesn't work. Well, statistics. You don't have the same when you cross the street.
If you hold the physician liable, no one will be the physician. Or the judge or the...
Well, that's the tikkun olam argument.
But that's like a practical, but you're saying really, he should be liable, but for practical reasons we're not holding him liable. I'm saying, like, from an ethical point of view, he shouldn't be held liable. So when that's something that they could not possibly avoid, that's intrinsic, like Jeff says, to there is a certain complication when you see this, he shouldn't be liable.
You have to have the informed consent of the patient. The patient should go into it knowing that he can refuse the procedure and suffer the consequences of the illness, or endure the procedure and potentially be at risk for whatever the situation.
But that's a double-edged sword, Jeff. Because on the one hand, you're saying we advise the patient of the risk, and the patient accepted that risk, and therefore it's the patient's problem. But on the other hand, if the physician goes in knowing that there's a risk that hand is going to slip, they're going to cause harm, this is a dangerous operation, then maybe we should hold them liable because they knew full well that they might harm the patient. You can make the argument the other way, Michael.
So we naturally compare it with someone who's comparably trained. So if something is a complication that can occur, and it's known to be a complication that can occur, even amongst equally trained surgeons or equally trained physicians, then that's the standard against which we have to judge.
Right.
Because anything could happen.
Right.
But if someone is creating a complication rate or doing things that are beyond what would normally be expected in that trained population, then we have to say, well, now they're doing something that perhaps they shouldn't be doing. Perhaps they're doing procedures they shouldn't be doing.
Right.
And creating complications they shouldn't be doing.
Right. I think, though, it's important to distinguish between two types of problem. One would be where everything that you did is what the comparably trained person would do to the T, but there's a standard risk associated. For example, you went to the doctor and I don't want to start giving medical cases because I'm just going to mess it up, but a person went to the doctor and the person is experiencing chest pain and the doctor prescribed a particular medication, which is by the book, that's what they're supposed to prescribe. And by the book, there are also side effects. And in this case, the side effect was terrible for the patient and harmed their health. That's one type where you did literally everything. And what you did is the same as what everybody else would do, and yeah, there was a problem. The other is where the case I gave here, where the surgeon's hand slips, where it's true that statistically that will happen in every certain number of cases. However, the physician, the surgeon, is expected to be careful in this case and to avoid it being the one in which this happens. I think there is a difference between the two different types of error. Jack?
Type of social contract in which you understand that you live in this society, the society licenses the physician just the same as society licenses bus drivers. You walk onto a city bus or an intercity bus, you're taking your life in your hands. You're giving your life to the driver. If that driver is licensed, then you understand that that's part of the social contract that, you know, someone's supervising this group of workers, doctors or bus drivers. And that you put your hands in, so it's really the licensing body that is responsible for telling you it's okay to use this service.
But it's not so. I mean, I don't want to claim to be a legal expert, but as I understand it, if the bus driver, in fact, is careless, and as a result, you know, causes an accident and people on the bus are hurt, the bus driver will be held liable. Now, in some societies, you will be able to sue the bus driver as well as the licensing body, and perhaps the parents of the people on the licensing body. But that was a joke. But the reality is that we don't indemnify the bus driver because he got training. There is an element here of physicians being different.
If it's raining or if there's icy roads and he's driving under the speed limit and doing everything by the book and quote-unquote his hand slips,
Right.
So,
you understand? I'm saying, like, there's this trust that people are saying that the supervising body trained these people and certified them.
Right. I'm going to go a little further with this, because we need to. I'm going to skip source number 8 and just explain briefly the question that was raised when I read this. I think Heshi asked, why is it that he's then liable in the hands of heaven? If he's exempt, because we want people to be doctors, then you should be also exempt him in terms of the laws of heaven. So Ramban Nachmanides tries to offer a solution to it, in which he says he's not liable at the hands of heaven either, unless he finds out what he did wrong. It's sort of a quantum mechanics theory of liability. If you don't observe it, if no one noticed the error, then you're not liable. However, once you find out that you did it, once you find out that you made the mistake, then now you're going to be liable at the hands of heaven for the error. That's what Nachmanides writes, and everybody struggles to understand what he's talking about. One school of thought is from Rabbi Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, in which he suggests, in an article in the journal Tchumen, the 19th volume, that it's because when a person makes a mistake like this, if they didn't know it and they never find out about it, they're not liable. However, if you find out that you caused this level of harm, then you should want, so to speak, to be liable. A person should feel terrible about the results of their actions, and they, so to speak, generate their own liability in that sense. There are others who give other explanations. Rabbi Bleich has a very interesting discussion in the article and tradition that I mentioned before. But you're right when you ask, why is he liable at the hands of heaven? And it's a great long discussion in its own right. But what we've said so far in terms of this case number 2 is that we exempt physicians for error because of tikkun ha'olam. However, take a look at source number 9, because it's not that simple. Source number 9 is yet another Tosefta, right? We've seen this is our third. There are actually 4, but I'm not quoting the fourth, because it's beyond the scope of what we're doing. But the third Tosefta in source number 9 says, Rofei umanjri pei birshus beisdin. If an expert doctor treats with court authorization, vihizik and causes harm, patur, he's exempt. But if he wounds more than is necessary, then he is liable. What in the world does more than necessary mean? I could envision that meaning an accident, severed like he gave in case number 2, the hand slipped. I could envision it as being intentional. He's already doing it, and he decides he's going to go do more. So what exactly are we talking about here when we say he is liable if he does more than he should have? So take a look at source number 10, please. In the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. The Imri Pei Birshus Beis Din, this is an extension of what we saw in source number 1. It's the rest of the line. If he heals with the authorization of the court, v'ta'a v'hizik, and he errs and he causes harm, patur b'dinei adam, v'chayav b'dinei shamayim, he is exempt under human law for his error, he's liable b'dinei shamayim in the laws of heaven. So, he's not liable for accident. Well, then what's going on in source number 9, where we're told he's liable if he does more than he should have? So take a look, please, at source number 11, the work of Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Avram, who discusses this in several places. This comes from his discussion of laws of liability. Yeh-ra-eh, he says it appears that he is liable to pay according to the letter of the law. And the same is true in all similar cases of treatments where experience has taught us that sometimes... I'm sorry, I should have given you the case beforehand. My mistake. The case that he's dealing with here is the case of a dentist who is supposed to drill a particular tooth, and the drill slips and he drills the wrong tooth, a healthy tooth. So that's the case that we're working with. He says, it appears that he is liable to pay according to the letter of the law. And the same is true in all similar cases of treatments where experience has taught us that sometimes one, I added in accidentally, treats healthy sites causing great harm. Of course, this is where he could have known clearly immediately which was the appropriate site, and he was negligent. So in other words, let's say you've all heard of the horror stories where the patient has the wrong leg operated on, right? And so they tell you to mark the leg, and they give all sorts of advice for patients. So if the physician knows there is such a possibility, then the physician is responsible to make sure that the right leg is going to be operated on, whether testing it, marking it, and so on. Sorry? Sorry?
Correct leg, not the right leg.
Okay, maybe that's how they get into trouble. So the physician is responsible to take those steps because they know that this is a possibility. The dentist is responsible to know this is the tooth I'm supposed to be operating on and to make sure when going in to use sufficient care so that they don't end up operating on or drilling into the wrong tooth. That's the rule of liability, that if it's negligence, and negligence is gauged based upon what the physician should have expected going in, then we're going to say that indeed this physician is going to be liable. This the Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Chiel Michael Epstein, ruled the same way. So what are examples of an unacceptable error? Take a look, please, at source number 12. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein discusses this. There are other responses of it. It's Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, in the fifth volume of his work. The Menchas Yitzchak, Rabbi Yitzchak Weiss, in the third volume of his work. I can give references for anyone who wants later. But I believe what Rabbi Feinstein does here is a good way to sum it up. He says, this depends on his wisdom and medical expertise, and the medication's tested success, and his examination of the patient with patience and great analysis in terms of the disease, as well as the patient's ability to endure surgery. That's what I expect from a doctor, he says. That he's going to evaluate carefully, use a medicine that's been tested, be patient with things, not only check the disease, but also how the patient can tolerate the surgery. If it was hasty, that is like carelessness, even if he felt no great analysis was needed. So not being thorough or being unduly hasty, and I say unduly because there are cases where you just have to act, but if the option was there to be more careful and the physician chose not to be careful, that's considered to be an unacceptable error. Now Rabbi Bleich, in his article, page 83, has a discussion also about failure to act and whether that can be called negligence. What if the physician didn't do something, didn't observe that a certain medication was needed, and so on? But it's beyond the scope of what I'm going to be able to get through tonight. But the general rule is that the physician will be held liable if, procedurally, they didn't take the care that's considered to be normal for that particular situation. So if the surgeon's hand slipped because the surgeon didn't get the type of sleep that was needed, and there are protocols, I understand, for this. If the surgeon's hand slipped because the surgeon was, in some way hampered in a way that she, he, whatever, should have known, then they're going to be liable. But otherwise, they're going to be exempt from liability. One last note within this category, within this case. We're getting close to the 1 hour mark, so I'm trying to work through it. The third case is a very quick one. The other point within this, what if the person who makes the mistake was given bad information? Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg discusses a case in which a surgeon is following the instructions of the physician on the case who said this, whatever it is necessary. Or where a nurse is given orders to give a particular medication, and in fact it's an inappropriate medication. So the general rule, it's beyond the scope of what we can get to tonight, but it's Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg writing in Techumen. He says, if they should not have been able to tell, if they don't possess the training to be able to tell that the treatment is wrong, it's going to go back to the doctor. Liability will go back to the person who gave the instruction. If they have the ability to tell, then in fact they are responsible to raise the red flag and not simply to say, well, the doctor told me to do it, therefore I'm going to do it. That's really the standard within halacha. I'm moving to case number 3. I'll stick around afterwards to discuss and deal with questions and so on, so please don't be afraid of me running out on it, and I'll be glad to follow up by email as well. Case number 3 is the hasty prescription. Alan is a trained, board-certified family doctor. A new patient consults Alan for back pain. Alan recommends Advil without asking about other medications that the patient is taking. The patient is also on heparin, and the interaction of the two medications leads to a bleeding stroke. Please don't tell me that this case is wrong. I did my research on it and did the best I could. If it's wrong, substitute for yourself any similar case in which the physician does not ask about an existing medication and the drug interaction leads to harm. Is Alan, the physician in this case, liable? What would you say?
Yes.
Yes. Responsible to ask questions. So here's it. Yeah, sorry.
Why is it even a question?
Ah, not. Why is this even a question? So I'll tell you why. This one is not an ethical discussion. This is an interesting halachic discussion. Take a look at source number 13, please. Source number 13, source number 14, those who are at the business ethics class on professional malpractice there are already familiar with this, with 13 and 14. But basically, we distinguish between two types of damage in Jewish law. One is called grama, and the other is called garmi. Grama is indirect harm. Frankly, so is garmi, but that's another story for another time. But the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says the following. If I throw my own item off of the roof, right, for my own reasons. I thought I was dropping something off of the roof in a safe way. I needed to get my piano down, and I thought there were cushions down below, and the piano was going to land just fine. Don't worry about it. In a case a little more reasonable than that. So I'm throwing something out the window over cushions that are going to safeguard it from breaking. Somebody comes along, some wise guy, after I throw the thing out the window, and he pulls away the cushions, and it smashes on the ground. So, Mechaber, Rabbi Yosef Karo, author of the Code of Jewish Law, says the person who took away the cushions is liable. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing for Ashkenazim in the early 16th century, says no, he's not. Because this was ultimately indirectly causing harm. This is what we call grama, because he didn't throw the thing off the roof. All he did was pull away the cushions, and then, oops, now harm was caused. But he didn't act on the object itself. His liability does not extend to indirect harm. That's one case. Second case is something called garmi. Garmi is also indirect harm, and yet in source 14 we are told that we do in fact punish people for damage caused through garmi. The classic example of garmi is the following. I am a money changer. In those days, going back to Talmudic times, you had someone whose job it was to examine coins and make sure that they were valid for use, that they had the right weight, that they were going currency, whatever it was. So if someone offered to buy something from you and they gave you coins and you weren't sure they were valid, you brought them to the money changer. The money changer looks at the coins you brought him and says, these look good. You accept the coins. And then when you try to use them, you're told, no, we don't use these, we don't accept these are worthless. That's called garmi, and the money changer is liable. Depending on whether he has certification, that's its own discussion. But the point is, he's liable for that. So why is he liable in this case with the money changer, right? And why is he not liable in the case of pulling away the cushions? So there are a few different legal theories behind it. One popular theory is simply that it's a matter of figuring out how direct the action was. How directly he caused the harm. The more direct your harm, the more likely you are to be liable. That's basically the distinction. So to give another example, in the days of the Talmud, it was known that if a person sold grain, this is still true in our supermarkets, frankly. If a person sells grain, the consumer expects there will be a certain percentage of it that will be just stones. You know, pebbles, dirt, whatever it is. So imagine that I go to somebody else's grain and I do them a favor. I de-stone the grain. So I cleaned it all out. Well, did I do him a favor? Is that a good thing? No, it's a bad thing, because now he has less volume to sell people and he's going to have to fill it in with actual grain. The consumer's going to win, but he lost. So I am liable there because I cost him money. And I did so more directly. The point is, we distinguish between more direct and less direct causes of harm. I don't view this as an ethical issue, but rather as a matter of the legal system. And so the question is, if the physician prescribes a medicine really carelessly against, you know, the norms of the trade, and it causes harm, do we view this as direct or indirect? So take a look at source number 15, please. Rabbi Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, in his article in Tchumen that I've referenced before, says, logically it appears the expert doctor who orders surgery or who prescribes medicine is liable, not the actual surgeon or the nurse who puts the medication in the patient's mouth. One may compare the prescribing doctor to one who harms with garmi, since the harm will be done at his command. He says, Rabbi Goldberg's position is that even though his involvement is less direct, somebody else gave the medication, somebody else did the surgery, nonetheless, he is direct enough to be considered liable for the harm. Rabbi J. David Bleich disagrees in Source 36 on three grounds. He says, first of all, there are, however, grounds to question whether erroneously prescribing a medication, ordering an injection, or counseling surgery generate liability even at the hands of heaven. In point of fact, other than perhaps in the case of an order issued to a nurse, it is far from certain that there is a necessary causal relationship between the practitioner's advice and the resultant harm, since patients frequently seek second opinions or ignore medical advice. So therefore, maybe you could argue there's an interrupt between the prescribing physician and the patient who is harmed. That's number one. Number two, he says, quite apart from the foregoing consideration, it would appear that the harm caused by a physician is not in the nature of garmi. The relevant paradigm is the case of a person who consults a money changer with regard to the value of a coin preferred to him, a proficient a master money changer requiring no further training, who renders an erroneous opinion regarding the value of a coin, is not liable. He hasn't been negligent, and the same would be true for a proficient physician who makes a bona fide error in prescribing a medication. That's not our case. In our case, he was careless. He's dealing with a case in which there was no carelessness involved. But basically, his position, or Bleich's position, is don't necessarily assume financial liability. That doesn't mean he did what was right, but it means that he may not be held liable because of the interrupt between his action and the ultimate harm to the patient. I frankly wonder whether there isn't a separate reason to be able to hold him liable, which is that whenever I enter into an agreement with a professional, I am entitled to assume a level of competence and a level of professionalism in what that professional does. So if I hire a house painter, and the house painter does a bad job, then he is liable for the harm that he caused to my house. In the event that I give somebody metal and I say, make this into whatever it is, and he does a bad job with it, he is liable for that, because what he did was not what he said he was going to do. So therefore, I wonder if we couldn't take source number 17 and say that where, in that case, you're talking about an expert money changer, if he was paid to do a job, he was paid to examine the coin, and in fact, he did a bad job of examining it, he is going to be liable to pay. I wonder if the same thing shouldn't be true, even where there's something indirect, even there where there's an interrupt. I wonder if we shouldn't be able to make that claim. The upshot of all of this, I want to do a very fast summary of what we've seen, and I know that I rushed towards the end. The number one is that we said that as far as the bystander is concerned, the person who's not a trained physician, so we said she's obligated to intervene to the best of her ability. She is indemnified from liability, number one, because she's required to do this, and therefore we can't hold her liable for the mistake. And number two, because we want people to continue to save lives and continue to intervene. I have to get back to you. If you didn't sign in, make sure to sign in. I have to get back to you on the case where what she did was entirely inappropriate, like the leeching case for the choking patient. Yeah, will we still say she's exempt from liability? Case number two, the surgeon's hand slips. So we said that as a general rule, the trend is that if the surgeon or the doctor got adequate training, got certified, and had a mistake happen that was really beyond their control, they're not going to be liable. If, however, there was an unreasonable error, they did more than they should have, which we included haste, we included not being thorough in the investigation, then they are going to be held liable. If they acted on bad information and they should have known better than to accept that information, they will be held liable as well. And then lastly, where the physician is careless, even though we will say they're undoubtedly in the wrong, they might escape financial liability in a Jewish court if there was an interruption between their action and the ultimate bad result. Please make sure before you go that you have an evaluation slip. They slip with the link to do the evaluation online, as I said in the beginning, but many people came in since then. We won't be able to offer credit for this unless we actually have people fill out the evaluation. We need a high percentage of evaluations. Number two, please note as well that if you had trouble, I know that one or two people said that they had trouble getting